Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 401, recorded on Sunday, November 28th, 2021. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, and joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
We thought we'd talk a little bit this week about the National Flood Insurance Program, partly because there were some other sort of flood and disaster-related things that were in the news, not about the disasters themselves, but about how the federal government handles those. And this is something that I've, you know, obviously thought about from time to time as a potential topic, but it seemed like a good time to talk about it now. And of course, as we traditionally have been doing, we will focus primarily on the historical aspects and then do some tie-ins to the current day situation. So, Rachel, I'll start with your research on this and the National Flood Insurance Act itself, which created the program in 1968. What was the background on that program? Why was it created, and what was sort of the intended and unintended effects of that program?
Yeah, so the act was introduced in 1968 after Hurricane Betsy occurred in 1965, and there was flooding associated with that. And it was originally designed to share the risk of flood damage through flood insurance, national public flood insurance, and reduce flood damage by restricting floodplain development. So it really hasn't succeeded at goal number two, and I think it's been increasingly apparent that it also hasn't really succeeded at goal number one either. So the program enables property owners in participating communities to purchase insurance protection administered by the government through the Federal Emergency Management Agency against losses from flooding, and it requires flood insurance for all loans or lines of credit that are secured by existing buildings, manufactured homes, or buildings under construction that are located in a special flood hazard area, an SFHA, in a community that does participate in this National Flood Insurance Program. U.S. Congress limits the availability of National Flood Insurance to communities that adopt adequate land use and control measures with effective enforcement provisions to reduce flood damages by restricting development in areas exposed to flooding. These areas are determined by the area of, quote, the flood, which has a 1% chance of being equaled or exceeded in any given year. This is more commonly known as the 100-year flood. So flooding that occurs approximately once every 100 years at that extreme level. So participation in the program is based on an agreement between local communities and the federal government that states that if a community will adopt and enforce a floodplain management ordinance to reduce future flood risk to new construction in these SFHAs, the federal government will make flood insurance available within the community as a financial protection against flood losses. The SFHAs and other risk premium zones applicable to each participating community are depicted on flood insurance rate maps. The mitigation division within FEMA manages the program and oversees the floodplain management and mapping components of the program. So, as I said before, the intent was to reduce future flood damage through community floodplain management ordinances and provide protection for property owners against potential losses through an insurance mechanism that requires a premium to be paid for the protection. In 2003, the Government Accountability Office found that repetitive loss properties cost the program about $200 million annually. Congress originally intended that operating expenses and flood insurance claims be paid for through the premiums collected for these flood insurance policies. The program does borrow from the U.S. Treasury for times when losses are heavy, and these loans are paid back with interest. So between 1978 and the year end of 2014, the U.S. federal government has paid more than $51 billion and claims under the National Flood Insurance Program. So this program has had some pretty big implications on home construction and land use, and also on the private insurance sector. There's a mix of positives and negatives. So some of the positive aspects are that the Act does really regulate land use in areas at high risk for flooding that do want to participate in the program. So they have to utilize this flood elevation and floodway data that is collected. It requires permits for developments in these flood areas. It determines whether proposed developments will be reasonably safe from flooding, determines that all necessary permits have been received from federal and state government agencies, including permits of the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, amendments of 1972. It requires that within flood-prone areas, that new and replacement water supply systems be designed to minimize or eliminate infiltration of floodwaters into the systems. It requires within flood-prone areas that new and replacement sanitary sewage systems be designed to minimize or eliminate infiltration of floodwaters into the systems and to minimize or eliminate discharges from the sewage systems into floodwaters. Pretty darn important there. It requires within flood-prone areas that on-site waste disposal systems be located to avoid impairment to them or contamination from them during flooding. It requires notification of adjacent communities prior to any alteration or relocation of a water course. It determines that the flood carrying capacity within the altered or relocated portion of any water course is maintained. And it requires that manufactured homes must be elevated and anchored to resist flotation, collapse, or lateral movement if a flood should occur. So these are pretty important requirements that just kind of protect public safety from things like sewage or contamination from like gas and or oil containment systems. So pretty important regulations. It also encourages communities to go above these minimum requirements, such as not placing public utilities in flood-prone areas. And it requires that or requests that access be provided to homes that ensures that houses do not become isolated during flooding, that they will have egress points where they can get to safety. However, one big negative to the program is that vulnerable people are pushed into flood-prone areas, which increases demand for disaster aid. Property owners in these flood-prone areas don't really want to take on the risk of maintaining ownership, so they'll often rent them out to poor people. So it's putting poor people, people that tend to have disabilities or other conditions that make it so they aren't making much money. So these communities are often poorer, more disabled, and they're put into these floodplains where they will require more assistance in the case of a disaster. So it really has kind of created some perverse incentives. Flood insurance for properties in flood-prone areas is mandatory only to secure loans, which makes it somewhat more likely that flood-prone properties will be owned by seniors who have paid off their mortgages or investors who have acquired the property outright without securing any credit for rental income. Flood insurance only covers losses for the owner of the property, and claims are subject to caps, which further increases the likelihood that the property will be occupied by renters rather than the actual property owner. Flood-prone properties are more likely to be offered for rent because of these increased risks and or costs associated with occupying the property themselves. And flood-prone properties are more likely to be offered for rent at a discount, which attracts lower-income groups, seniors, and infirm groups. Another big negative of the program is that there haven't really been any real penalties for rebuilding on flood-prone land. According to critics of the program, the government subsidized insurance plan, quote, encouraged building and rebuilding in vulnerable coastal areas and floodplains. Stephen Ellis of the group Taxpayers for Common Sense points to properties that flooded 17 or 18 times that were still covered under the federal insurance program without premiums going up. Critics say this program is underperforming because it is starved for funding compared to disaster response and recovery, and the process for applying for a buyout of a flood-damaged house is unreasonably slow. So if you are the owner of a property that is kind of prone to continual damage on a pretty regularly reoccurring basis, you can apply for FEMA to buy out your property, and you just cut your losses and move away. However, because this program is so underfunded, This process is really slow. People have been waiting for years to get a buyout for their house, and they're just kind of stuck where they're at until they can get that buyout offer because they can't afford to go anywhere else. Another negative of the program is that many Americans vastly underestimate their flood risk. So a lot of owners, homeowners, believe that they don't even really need flood insurance, or they think that flood insurance is already part of their home insurance policy, which it is not required that that be a part of your policy. Only 3% of homeowners believe that they are at moderate to severe risk of flooding within the next 2 years. However, between 1996 and 2019, 99% of counties in the U.S. were impacted by flooding, and currently only 15% of the homeowners have flood insurance. There are private flood insurance policies, but actuarially, providing flood insurance, it doesn't really make financial sense for insurance companies. So not a lot of companies offer this, and they can be really picky about who they offer plans to. If you've had flood damage in the past, or if you live in a high-risk area, you likely can't access a private flood insurance plan. By contrast, the National Flood Insurance Program is available to all homes within these SFHAs, but the payouts are capped versus private policies where you can kind of choose your coverage. And disaster aid may be slow to arrive, as FEMA funds may be distributed through insurance companies that FEMA has outsourced policies to. So getting your funds may take a really long time. And because only the riskiest properties are in the NFIP pool, premiums would normally be high to cover that risk. However, rates for many policies are subsidized, or lower older rates are kind of grandfathered in, which really creates a perverse incentive to continue building in flood-prone areas because you just aren't being forced to pay high premiums for living in high-risk areas. So there's been quite a few, unintended consequences that have occurred due to this program. Over the years, the Act has been amended several times since 1968. In 1973, the Flood Disaster Protection Act of 1973 made flood insurance mandatory for the protection of property within SFHAs. In 1982, the Coastal Barrier Resources Act designated areas that were ineligible for federal insurance or other financial aid. And this was designed to protect fragile coastal barriers from development, as well as discourage development of land at severe risk of flooding and avoid wasteful federal expenditures. In 1994, the National Flood Insurance Reform Act codified the community rating system, which incentivizes going above the minimum requirements of the NFIP. And in 2004, the Flood Insurance Reform Act sought to reduce losses to properties for which repetitive flood insurance claim payments have been made. So kind of trying to put a stop to those properties that have made 17 or 18 claims over the years. So how are these floodplains determined? Engineers determine the floodplain by evaluating a community's rainfall and river flow data, topography, wind velocity, tidal surge, flood control measures, building development, both existing and planned, and community maps. So the floodway is the area of the floodplain where velocities and water depths are the greatest during flooding events, and the flood fringe is the portion of the floodplain outside of this floodway. Many factors can change the floodplain status of an area, which would then need to be amended. Errors in topographical readings can occur, or elevation can change over time. Also, you can manually add fill to, like fill dirt to areas to raise the elevation of land out of the floodplain. However, a revision of floodplain delineations based on topographic changes must demonstrate that any topographic changes have not resulted in a floodway encroachment. Development increases runoff in urban areas, which can increase flood risk. If flood maps were created before development occurred, the flood maps can be out of date and require revision. For example, construction that narrows the floodplain increases flow rates, which can cause higher floodwaters and greater backflow in an area, which increases the flood damage. And if changes to an area that affect flooding conditions are discovered, the information must be submitted to the NFIP administrator within 6 months. This is so premium rates and floodplain management requirements are based on current data, and the most educated calculations can be made. It's a pretty complicated, complex program. I don't know if it really is achieving the goals that it kind of started out trying to prevent development on these floodplains or mitigate the damages from flooding. It's kind of created a lot of unintended and perverse circumstances, I think.
Yeah, and I think that it's sort of reflective of the dilemma in its origins and creation in 1968, right? To quote from a Grist article that I'll be citing later in this episode again, the National Flood Insurance Program was created in 1968, a time when many private insurance companies found flood insurance too risky. To cover the escalating costs of cleaning up after floods, the feds created their own insurance program, offering discount rates to convince people to buy in. It may have seemed like a good idea at the time, but over the years, the situation has become pretty preposterous. The government's cut-rate insurance encouraged building and rebuilding in vulnerable coastal areas and floodplains. And some of the same people that Rachel quoted, who are critics of the program, are quoted in that piece as well. And again, it's like there was a genuine dilemma, right? Which is that the private sector was either totally ready to exit the market for flood insurance, or the rates they would have been willing to charge people were simply, you know, just prohibitive from the point of view of the residents who needed that insurance. And so the federal government has to step in there because the private sector isn't handling the situation. There's no other alternative, and the people who do live there do need help. But the challenge that has brought along with that is the political implications of that decision, which is that nobody really wants to go against the real estate developers and all the residents who live in these places, especially if they're older homeowners, you know, or they're commercial people that own a whole bunch of properties and so forth that they rent out. These are all constituencies that add up to people saying, well, we got to, you know, still help them out. This is a tough situation, et cetera. And so politically, there's a lot of incentives against actually fixing the problem. And so the situation keeps on getting worse and worse. So I wanted to talk about two recent reforms or anti-reforms on this program since the 2004 reform that Rachel talked about. And then we'll talk about some other sort of related current day disaster emergency spending that the government makes besides this program. So in 2011 and 2012, there was a successful effort to pass a significant reform to the National Flood Insurance Program, although don't get too comfortable with that success. The Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012 tried to more accurately price the legitimately high flood risks to some properties into their owners' federal flood insurance costs, partly to contain disaster relief cost burdens for the government, but also partly to start trying to light a fire under people to get out of recurring flood areas or make changes to their property to permanently mitigate flooding. This Biggert Waters 2012 reform became law several months before Hurricane Sandy later in 2012, a timing which likely contributed to its immediate rollback in the next Congress. Or at least I should say a rollback of the insurance cost and discount changes. Some of the other reforms that Rachel alluded to about floodplain mapping changes were retained. But the really sort of key critical part about the insurance itself that was meant to start to accurately bring this closer into alignment with reality and try to get people to stop building and rebuilding in these floodplains without just saying flat out, that's, you know, the new edict. There was just a lot of pressure to cancel that aspect of the reform. That brings us to 2014. So over the course of 2013 and 2014, there was a successful attempt to pass a rollback. The Homeowner Flood Insurance Affordability Act, signed into law in March 2014, essentially delayed, perhaps indefinitely, the 2012 reforms that would have reduced premium subsidies and jacked up the artificially and unreasonably low federal flood insurance rates for homeowners in risky areas. One argument used to justify rolling back the 2012 reform from 2 years earlier was that it had been unfair because only a small share of properties were getting increased insurance costs under the plan, and plenty of other properties would have seen no change despite themselves being very frequently flooded. Ironically, one of the members of Congress demanding the repeal of Biggert Waters was Maxine Waters herself, one of the co-sponsors, who seemed startled by the level of backlash there was to the 2012 reform. And again, I think there was a lot of pressure after Hurricane Sandy for people going, oh no, that's unreasonable. You can't do this to me. there's about 5.5 million properties currently in the National Flood Insurance Program. About a fifth of those, 20% or so, receive discount rates of less than half of what a private insurance company would charge them. But again, the federal government can't just raise it to 100% of what the private sector would do, because there was a reason the private sector left and there was a reason that nobody could afford that private insurance. So it's difficult to figure out what to do in this situation. But clearly, as Rachel has demonstrated at great length, the program as it exists is not really working. Now, one idea that was floated during around the time of the 2013-2014 reverse reform efforts was floated by Howard Kunreuther, a professor at the Wharton Risk Management and Decision Processes Center at the University of Philadelphia, along with other colleagues there. And he proposed, and this is, I'm citing now a quote from that Grist article from about 2013, which was about sort of the, you know, pressures on FEMA and the flood insurance program to get on a better fiscal track. Here's the idea that he floated. There should be created a system of vouchers that help people who need help to pay their rising insurance rates on the condition that they take measures to make their properties less vulnerable. To finance the improvements, the government would offer low-interest loans. And presumably, by the time the work was done, the property owner's risk, and therefore his or her insurance rates, would have come down substantially. And basically, that would help them pay it off. They would be paying less in insurance rates, and so they would be able to pay back the loan that was made to make those improvements in the first place. As far as I know, this has not been implemented yet. In 2015 and 2017, there were some reform and then anti-reform efforts on this as well. President Obama issued an executive order in 2015 on flood risk management, which would have required factoring in future climate change effects on flood risk assessments. President Trump promptly canceled this executive order in 2017, about half a year into his term. So that's where we're going to leave it on the National Flood Insurance Program itself. But I wanted to zoom out a little bit and look at some of the other sort of disaster payment schemes that the federal government has that are going to increasingly become a problem, whether it's flooding from climate change related events and storm surges and things like that, or whether it's forest fires, also exacerbated by climate change, any of these type of things. There's various different programs through various departments. Some of it's the FEMA ones that people know about. There's other ones like this housing and urban development one that we're going to talk about today that have been in the news more recently. And I think point to some trends to keep an eye on that are certainly troubling in that particular sphere. So we've just spent the time talking about the federal government intervening in a space where the private sector was leaving the market, but we also talked about how slow a lot of those processes are. Now let's look at a place where the federal government had stepped in to address a situation, and then the private sector is saying, ooh, goody goody, we can get our fingers in this too and get some revenue streams out of this. Essentially, the gist of it is that federal emergency payments for disaster relief under certain programs can be so slow that private companies are financializing the time gap. And this is something that Rachel and I talk about a lot off the air and have talked about in certain episodes that we've done as well. The idea that really sort of hardcore end stage financialization, or at least the current stage of financialization, is the part where you manipulate the passage of time to create profits, as opposed to, you know, various other earlier phases of capitalism where you'd be manipulating some other lever to try to generate profits. The idea is, you know, we talked a lot about this on our consumer finance episodes and sort of the American Money series that we did. If you charge everyone payment plans and, you know, spread out their purchase of something over a higher interest installment system over a longer period, they're willing to pay that because it's a little bit at a time, and so they'll pay more. Therefore, you've created a new profit stream that you can harvest if you're one of these financializing entities. And then you can take that, you know, payment plan, bundle it up with thousands of other payment plans, and sell that as like a, you know, tradable asset and so forth. So we talked about that on previous episodes. So now let's look at another aspect of financializing time, which again is where you are taking advantage of a gap between one thing happening and another thing happening, in that there's a time difference between those things, so it's not instantaneous. And the way that you are extracting profit is by manipulating that gap in the time. So New York Times article, November 23rd, 2021, that's last week as we're recording this. Headline, as federal disaster aid languishes, private lenders are filling the gap. A new program allows Morgan Stanley to front money for disaster repairs and then get paid back with interest by taxpayers. Now, I want to emphasize here before we jump into this, I think some people were passing this around, and that was my initial impression, thinking this was like about FEMA disaster payments to individuals. This is not. This is about a specific different program, but we'll circle back to the FEMA aspect in a few minutes. So this specific program covered in this article is related to HUD. It's aimed at serving owners of large apartment buildings as opposed to individuals affected by disasters, and it is structured as a loan advance of the expected disaster payouts. The federal government's Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, would then eventually provide the funds to the property owner to not only repay the loan, but repay it with interest as compensation to the institutional lender, like Morgan Stanley or some other company. And that is compensating that lender for fronting that money to that large property owner. In a sense, by agreeing to this program, the federal government is, you could argue, contracting out the claims processing phase because of their own staff and the local municipal staff who often have to administer this type of program don't have enough resources or employees to handle claims in a timely manner. That's one factor in the time gap. But just as importantly, it's emphasized throughout this article and some of the other sources that I read on this, it also reflects a very Byzantine structure of congressional disaster funding appropriations, which are done one at a time and increasingly slowly. There is not a system of consistent pre-funding of some sort of reserve account for these inevitable and we can see increasingly frequent natural disasters. Instead, everything has to be approved on an ad hoc basis, one at a time. Congress has to say, okay, we're going to appropriate X amount of dollars for this particular disaster or this set of disasters. And then they give that money and then the federal government can start to distribute it. And it's often distributed, as I mentioned earlier, through the local government. So there's yet another filter layer. The result of this, again, is a time gap where it takes quite a while. And it also it gets slower and slower every year, it seems like, between when the disaster happens and when Congress finally passes something. So it takes many, many months, often several years, to get this disaster money started out the door and completed, getting spent to the places that it needs to go. And again, in this case, we are talking about a fairly narrow program here. We're talking about the big property owners with rental, apartment complexes. We're not talking about people with their individual single family homes and so forth. But I think this is an illustrative phenomenon that is going to have implications beyond this particular program. Now, for institutional investors, there is an added benefit on top of the government interest payments, right? Which, like, already right off the bat, they're creating a profit stream just by getting the federal government to agree to pay them some interest for doing this program. But they are also probably usually the same companies that are backing these large rental property buildings in the first place. So they have an interest in getting repairs done quickly and getting renters back in the units because that's critical to the cash flow on one of these buildings. Oftentimes these are structured as a, I don't want to get too into the nuts and bolts of how real estate is structured, but, you know, it would be set up as sort of a company where, you know, you're expecting to get a certain amount of money every year out of your renters or every month out of your renters. And that's flowing back to your investors because in most cases, you're not going to have one guy who has all of the capital resources to own a project of any significant size. So he would have these type of institutional lenders behind him who are expecting to get repayments made or they are profit sharing investors who are going to share in the profits as opposed to getting loans repaid. So these companies have an incentive to get these buildings repaired quickly, more quickly than the federal government has been getting this money out the door. So they've basically gotten a double benefit here where they get these buildings back on track and hopefully some tenants back in the buildings. Although I think it's worth asking whether these are the same tenants as before. I would guess probably not in a lot of cases. But in theory, if you were able to really dramatically shorten the repair time, maybe you could get someone who had been living there previously out of their temporary emergency housing and back in this building on a relatively short time frame. That's what their like humanitarian pitch is for this particular program. But again, remember, even though they are getting a benefit out of this, they are also getting a profit benefit, which is that the federal government is paying the interest on this loan scheme. So they've now created this out of the time gap. A couple more citations here to understand this program. The Times article references research from the Urban Institute on federal disaster aid. I took a look at that, and that found that most FEMA assistance ends after 18 months, if not earlier. And at that point, this type of program kicks in. The average community development block grant disaster recovery money for housing activity has yet to spend its first dollar after 18 months. The Urban Institute found that the average CDBG-DR housing activity started distributing funds 20 months after the disaster and was still distributing funds 2 years after that. Experts quoted in the Times piece all basically said the same thing. Essentially, the federal disaster money programs are indeed extremely slow and they need to respond faster. That's not something that the private sector is inventing out of thin air. But this financialization lending scheme is clearly another step in a dangerous direction of creating new profit streams out of a collapsing climate that hardly incentivizes real fixes, either to the climate itself or to our response strategies to climate-fueled natural disasters. It's also difficult to see a clear relationship between faster private loans to large residential landlords after disaster and the renter residents themselves benefiting, which, as I said, is in theory one of the points of getting these building repairs payments made available faster. Again, to recap here, the problem is these companies have now found a way in this at least one narrow program, which I think is going to be a harbinger of more to come, in which they make profit and make money off of A, the government process for responding to a disaster being slow, bad, and incompetent, which is a function itself of diminishing the state capacity and the administrative capacity and the number of employees and that kind of thing, right? And they're making a profit off of the existence of the disaster in the first place, right? Because they're charging interest on this, they are making money if there is a disaster, and it's guaranteed that they're going to get this profit back. We talked about that on a previous episode as well in our money series, I think, where we talked about the difference between profit-sharing capitalism and lender-oriented capitalism. The lenders always know they're going to get paid back, especially if they control all the levers of power and structure these government programs to guarantee those repayments are made as opposed to having a risk of default, right? The profit-sharing capitalist mode is somewhat different because that's based on the, you know, relative success or lack thereof of some particular venture. They have managed to come up with a situation in which they are profiting from the government being dismantled and hollowed out and from the disasters getting worse. So where does this signal for the future? Because this is, again, just one fairly narrow program related to HUD and related to these disasters affecting large apartment blocks. And as we know, in a lot of cases, these disasters are going to, you know, rip through a single family neighborhood or rip through a trailer park or something like that, right? That's what you see on TV when you see one of these disasters. That's what people are often focusing on. And for good reason, because there's a lot of people that are affected by those. So here's my wild speculation. This is not from the Times article, but this is me interpreting, you know, reading between the lines, looking at the structure of this program, which I think is in some ways is unusual, and kind of thinking about the various trends that Rachel and I talk about both on and off the air all the time. Let's drill down again on that aspect of how do you financialize the time gap? How do you make money itself off of the difference in time and that is the primary source of your increasing profits, right? Because everything else, you are eventually scraping the bottom of the barrel or the well is going dry. So now you need to figure out how to create money out of thin air, essentially, by something being a long, slow time gap or something extended over time, which doesn't need to be. And that's the critical part, right? Because we have the ability, if we wanted to, we could make changes to these type of programs and make them act faster, have better staffing levels, things like that. And then you would crunch down that time gap and it would no longer make sense to do this, right? Here's what I think is the next stage of this. We move away from this model of saying, here's the full amount you get fronted in advance, we will collect our profits from the federal government in the form of interest payments. You move away from that gap because that only really works if you're talking about these large capital intensive projects like a big apartment building or something, right? That's not as much of a viable model if you're talking about like one person in their single family home who's trying to get some federal assistance that they've been waiting on for 2 years for some reason, to, you know, fix something with their home or maybe make some of those improvements we talked about to try to mitigate the flood risks in the future. So in my speculation, the next likely logical step down this neoliberal avenue would be a financialization program that generates profits instead by paying ordinary people who will have federal claims, paying them in cash quickly for an amount less than the expected payout, and claiming instead the full amount for this lender from the federal government. There are already a number of private sector models for this model of doing it in other arenas. Examples include for, you know, and this is something that's covered a lot on the podcast Trash Future, things like slow invoice payments for freelancers on the sort of small end. There are companies that will say, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we'll pay you the, you know, amount or something close to the amount of money that you were expected to get on your invoice. And then we're going to go hound the person that was supposed to pay you, and they're going to pay us the full amount. So you don't have to be waiting around. You'll get less than you would have gotten, but hey, who knows? Maybe you weren't going to get paid that invoice at all ever, right? So that's their manipulation of the time gap that exists in that. And that's on a very small scale. On the macro scale, you have the now disgraced Greensill operation. So the way that that worked was that they discounted advances on major corporate accounts receivable cash flows. Greensill is now under investigation for this practice and all kinds of shenanigans in various countries around the world. But the gist of how that worked is that you'd say, okay, here is one major company, here is another major company. Company A, they sold an item to Company B. So Company B has to make a large payment of, let's say, $100 million to Company A. Company A could really use that money right now. Company B is dragging its heels or has some sort of payments, you know, calendar that they always make to make their payments. So that $100 million is just kind of sitting over with Company B right now, but Company A needs it because they had to buy all the materials for the thing that they sold to Company B and so forth. So you say, okay, well, Company A, you're expecting to get $100 million. A company like Greensill would step in, and this is a simplification here, but the gist of it is they would step in and say, okay, we're going to pay you $95 million. You'll get it right away, and then we'll go collect the full $100 million from the company that owed you $100 million. So you have the money right now, and we'll get the money later. And the profit is that difference that basically of the discount. And again, Greensill is collapsing, but I think you can see the kernels of what's going to probably happen if we continue with this financialization of disaster aid model. Instead of saying, here's the full amount, we'll collect some interest from the government later, what they're going to do, especially at the individual level, as opposed to the institutional level, with, you know, between corporations, what they're going to start doing is saying, okay, you have a claim for, you know, $100,000 here. We're going to give you $75,000 of that right now, rather than you having to sit around for years trying to argue with the government to get the $100,000. And then we're going to now have the rights to collect the full $100,000 from the government later on. That is my guess as to where this is going. And maybe this has already started to crop up some places and we just haven't seen coverage of it yet. But that's my guess on where things are going. So Rachel, as we wrap up, I want to circle back to you now, looking at the big picture of everything we've talked about today and about this scheme, what your thoughts were on all of that.
Well, it really reminded me of our previous episode that we did about funding that HUD was giving out for a development of lower income housing and how financial institutes were able to really take advantage of this program.
You're referring to the low income housing tax credits.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Were structured as a tradable credit that people could buy and sell on the market. And again, that difference in the discount rate is a creation of profit out of a government giveaway, essentially to subsidize housing construction.
Yeah. So these financial institutions are really able to take advantage of the holes and gaps in public administration for housing or disaster payouts or what have you. And so they really can I guess this is a phrase you see a lot on the internet and kind of the darker corners. They're monetizing the rot. So they're really able to take advantage of the gaps and the places where the government is really falling short to make money. So I have to say I agree with your wild speculation, just because there are these companies that are really trying to find ways to take advantage of people not being able to access public funding and kind of or like you said, the freelancers aren't able to get their invoices paid or whatnot. So I think I really do see this happening, this financialization that's profiting off of these like single family homeowners or these small business owners to get their federal claims fronted to them for profit on the back end. So yeah, it's kind of a grim view. We talked about before we started recording just how the federal government is becoming less and less able to administer these programs and how private companies are stepping into this gap to the detriment of the citizenry, basically.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about the National Flood Insurance Program and also the private sector boring its way into the side of the decaying and rotting government structures that they've spent the last 50 or 60 years lobbying to hollow out.
Thanks. Glad to be here, despite such a grim topic.